Nooks is the first agent workspace for sales, a unified platform where AI agents and human sales reps work together in real time. Instead of getting buried in manual tasks, you work alongside AI that prospects, prioritizes, and drafts outreach for you. When it comes to outbound, stop managing sequences and start selling with Nooks. Visit nooks.ai today. That's nooks.ai.
This is the Sales Gravy Podcast. Hi, I'm Jeb Blunt, best-selling author of Fanatical Prospecting, Objections, Sales EQ, and Inked, and I'm here to help you open more doors, close bigger deals, and rock your commission check.
All right, welcome back to the Sales Gravy Podcast. I'm here in the Blue Studio at Sales Gravy Headquarters with Dana Williams, who has been here shooting new courses for Sales Gravy University. Dana is the author of The Diligence Fix, an awesome book that I highly recommend reading. She is a wonky sales nerd, just like me. She loves sales culture, sales leadership. She's also the CXO at Myers-Briggs, so she's got a big-time job in the corporate world. And she is the chairperson for ATD's Sell Conference and a big wig over at ATD doing all kinds of crazy stuff. I keep running to you over there. So you've got this huge background, but you've come down to little old Sales Gravy to shoot some videos for Sales Gravy University. And I'm just curious about what you've been working on.
Yeah, well, there's no place I'd rather be. So thank you. Really, I was looking for a home to hang my Diligence Fix content. It came about after 20 years of passive pattern recognition, working with CEOs, CROs, VPs of sales across all spectrum, right? Fortune 1000, midsize, all of that. And realizing that no matter what vertical, what industry they were in, they struggled with the same issues. I rolled all that up. I put it in the 10 dimensions required for a diligent organization. And then you and I explored what was possible, and here we are.
I love that. So you've had a chance to work with our team here in studio. So just I always ask people who are sitting in the studio with me, what's it been like coming here to our little town of Thompson, Georgia, and working with our production team?
Well, the town is charming, and your team is so professional. I mean, it was just the process was so clear. It was very obvious where I needed to plug in, and we just had a great time kind of blowing through, fine-tuning, getting it just right, because putting this content on the platform, we know we're going to reach so many different people, and we want it just to be as good as it can be, and I feel good about that.
And they had really nice things to say about you as well. They said that you are way better than me, that you tore through the content, created these videos, that you were completely dialed in. So congratulations. That's good.
They
watch everybody come through. So when they say that, they mean it. And they really do mean it about me. I'm terrible. Like I make all the mistakes in the world. Let's dive in real quickly to the Diligence Fix. So the first time I ever heard of this book, I was in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
I was running out of the room because I had to go get on the airplane to go to Australia. And you handed me this book and said, read this book. I took it on the airplane with me and
yes.
Read it. And it was fantastic. Very well written, easy to understand, a unique perspective on go-to-market and leadership and growing a business and building a sales culture. When I say unique, there are not a lot of books that are written that are so dialed into that particular subject, creating resilience in your sales organization and the systems to do that. So I'm wondering if you could just walk us through your inspiration for the book, but what are some of the key lessons that people should take out of this book? And by the way, y'all can pick this book up on Barnes & Noble or on Amazon. Just go get the book. You'll like it. But give us some of the lessons.
Yeah. So I found that, when I really thought about high performing sales organizations and then organizations that wanted to get there, but really couldn't, I tried to distill it down into what is the common problem. And what I found, Jeb, was that essentially you had a bunch of like high enthusiastic leaders. They were fast starters, but they were crappy finishers.
That's what Pat Lencioni says in The Working Genius. They didn't have tenacity. It's the tenaciousness to finish things.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And I found it was that middle of the race. Think about when you run a marathon, right? It's kind of like that middle of the race where instead of staying the course with the plan and the strategy that you were so convinced about, there was this almost boredom, or there was this, you know, I didn't see that circumstance coming. Let's switch things on people. And what they didn't realize is that while it's easy to change your mind as a leader, the downstream effect of that is destabilizing. So that was sort of one piece. The other thing I noticed is that, you know, boards, CEOs, state, you know, they pushed for growth quarter after quarter. And when you continue to move up the growth ladder, if you don't mind the shop, if you don't address the creaky infrastructure, it starts to break.
Yes.
Because that infrastructure was built for a lower level of growth.
Yes. So essentially you advance on the battlefield past your supply lines.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that.
So you said that they get bored and they change things up.
Yes.
What it reminds me of is adrenaline junkies.
Right.
Right. So adrenaline junkies, they want to jump out of airplanes. They want to climb mountains. They want always a new challenge. They want to be in a situation where there's a possibility that they could die at any moment. Mm-hmm. I know that because I've been down that road in a particular sport that was going to kill me at some point in my life if I didn't quit. So that's what an adrenaline junkie does.
Right.
In the business place, in the workplace, salespeople, for example, that are adrenaline junkies, they're the salespeople that will allow themselves to almost fall off a cliff before they're miserable, they're scrambling, but then they'll do everything possible to save their life, and then they'll do it again and again.
Exactly.
Or, you know, they get bored, and so they just start messing things up to see if they can fix them. I've seen leaders do that. They'll get bored, and they'll just stir the pot so that they can create some drama so that suddenly that their adrenaline fix is being filled. But I notice that a lot with especially these people you talk about. They're high energy driven. They love closing the deal. And then they get in these leadership positions and it's a little bit more boring. So I'm bored. So let's just do something new.
And I find that that often happens because they become disconnected from what it takes to actually run the revenue generating organization. Most of them are promoted to that level because they did crush their quota. They did model growth quarter after quarter, but they don't always take the step to understand, make it their business. How do these different departments work? How do they overlap? What does it take for us to combine our efforts to create the value that the customer needs? They don't become a student of the business.
So Peter principles in play. They've been promoted to the level of their incompetence.
Yeah. Well, to some extent. Yeah. Or I have also found on the flip side, you get an uber conservative leader and they're just afraid to make any changes. So it's kind of like it's a spectrum. Leadership's always a spectrum.
Yeah, I see that, especially in sales organizations, in some industries, a lot of family-owned organizations where the organization has gotten successful up to a point and there is a real fear from those leaders, mostly because they haven't experienced anything else. Like they've been in this one place their entire life that if they change things up to reach the next level, the downside of that could be really bad for them or the organization. So they're so conservative that they hold the organization back. Now, the other side of that sword is that sometimes those leaders are keeping the organization from growing too fast, which could torch it. So it is a give and take. When you talk about organizational or sales resilience in the diligence phase, can you help me understand what specifically that means?
So with the idea of diligence, I took a research-based approach and I was able to break it up into 10 dimensions of diligence. It comprises all of part two of the book. Within the 10, 5 you and I would easily recognize as like core sales capability, right? Persuasive communication, intentional listening, all the goodies, right? The second 5 is what I call personal leadership capabilities. And my premise on that is, why do we save leadership training for people when they reach the manager level? Why are we not teaching individual reps who we say we want them to run their own business? Right? Run your territory like it were your own business. Why are we not supplementing them with key leadership principles? The 5th one on those personal leadership dimensions is inner resolve. And it's this idea of how do you achieve resilience in the face of stresses and setbacks? Do you know your triggers? Have you developed a series of coping strategies? These are not things we typically talk about in the sales training domain.
You're
but
exactly
why
right.
not?
But we teach them in the military. I mean, think about it. Most people in the military have gone through some level of resilience training.
Right.
We have a tendency to talk about it. I mean, fanatical prospecting is the whole book is basically a book about being resilient in the face of rejection. And yet, do we actually teach the what does it take to be resilient?
Exactly.
Now, part of that is, I think, generational. Okay, so let's just go back and think. So my parents were the baby boomers, right? So they came up after the greatest generation, so World War II, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the folks that came out of World War II weren't teaching you resilience. They were keep calm, carry on. Like, just what's wrong with you? Get up and go.
Yes.
Their children, they went out and, you know, did what that generation, what most generations do when they come from a generation who had to, as they say, I think an old Chinese saying, they had to go up the stairs in wooden shoes.
Right.
My parents' generation walked down the stairs in velvet slippers.
Okay.
Right. So they had the ability to have the 60s and the freedom, and they went to Woodstock and they sang and they protested, and then they all grew up,
mm-hmm.
and they had Gen X.
Okay.
Now, my generation, I mean, you think about resilience, and I don't know where you fit in this generation.
I am tail end, right. Gen X.
Okay. We're in the same boat. Like, we were like I think they called us the lost generation at some point because our parents were all working.
Right.
We were all latchkey kids, essentially.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like we were protected. There weren't helicopter parents. It was like, go out and play and get home before night. I mean, I was in high school with really good parents and I didn't even have a curfew. It was like, get home. When the sun comes up, you better be in bed. And oh, by the way, if you come in late, your dad's going to make you get up and build fences all day long to teach you not to get in late.
Right.
So when we thought about that, like, resilience was just go. Like, mm-hmm. what's wrong with you? And I mean, still in my Gen X world, when people are like, I don't feel very resilient, I'm like, well, just be resilient. What's wrong with you? Like, you know, just decide.
Well, and like anything else, some people are born with that as an innate strength and skill. And if that's great, I say your role is to help somebody else. But it's, you know, beyond generations, there are people that still struggle because they haven't become conscious of the fact that you have to know your triggers, what sets you off course, and then what sophisticated, you know, toolbox do you have to deal with that? And everything can't be an emotional gut reaction.
Exactly. I'm just making the point that you've got three generations that
sure.
came out of just buck up and get it done.
Yes.
I mean, even Obama, the night ago, Barack Obama told the Democrats who are, if you're getting into politics for a minute, told them they just need to toughen up. Like he said, like you need more resilience, but just toughen up.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk at people that way. Now we've moved in millennials and the Gen Z group
mm-hmm.
who are coming in who are much more aware of this. I think Gen Z is probably more than anybody. Their generation is the anxiety generation, right? So they demonstrate and I'm generalizing this, but marked lack of resilience
mm-hmm.
at this stage in their generation, mostly because we created an environment, including the pandemic, that put them in a situation where we didn't teach any coping mechanisms whatsoever.
Yeah.
So it's generationally, this is probably a really good time to start having that conversation. But the military has gotten this for a long time. Like, you go to resilience training. They teach you how to remain mentally resilient, and they give you drills to be mentally resilient in really tough situations, because if you're not, you get people killed.
Sure.
Right. In the business world, you get people fired, or you ruin their lives, or, you know, you traumatize them in some way, which I've seen some leaders do. So what's the answer there? Like, do organizations need to start building some intentionally focused resilience training? And maybe even we say per role. Like, I'm not sure you could do resilience training for accountants that would have the same impact for sales leaders and sales professionals.
Yeah, so I just wanted to open up the dialogue of, there's obviously the conventional competencies or capabilities that you would train for sales, but what are some of the other things that we often assume people have, but if we did a diagnosis, we couldn't be certain that everybody has, right?
I'm positive.
And that's one of them.
I was sitting with a sales leader just a few weeks ago who was asking, like, you know, we were talking about, you know, people having a closing, like a drive to close.
Yeah.
He goes, I just think it's an intuition. Like, you just have it. I said, I can't scale intuition. I can't scale that they believe that way. Why aren't they closing? Like, what is it? What's happening inside of them that keeps them from asking? And he didn't have the answer for it. Now, I went out with the rep, and the rep was like, I just don't know. Like, if I'm doing the right thing at the right time, that's happening between the ears. I think that's something that you can fix. I think you can scale resilience. I think you can build a resilient culture.
Right. Oh, there's that word.
Wow.
Huh.
So let's just say that you're in a position in the organization. You've got a sales group. Let's say you have a couple hundred salespeople. What would you do to develop a resilient sales culture, like a group of people who they woke up and they could take what was coming at them, they could take adversity, and they could manage their mindset, manage their thought process, manage their emotions, and still perform at a high level?
Yeah. So I always like to simplify culture down into essentially, hey, listen, it's just a collection of the mindset and the behaviors and just the way things are done around here. I think that helps to demystify that. Because a lot of leaders I find can become enamored with the idea of culture, but culture is inherently tactical. It's what you live out each and every day. And so if you have a high stress, if it's a, you know, rewards and risk and consequence culture, right, and that's out of balance, that's what, it's like a mirror. The culture reflects what's permitted, what's allowed. And so if you don't have the ability to model the right mindset, espouse the right beliefs, and then reward and recognize the right behaviors, you're going to have people that are an emotional roller coaster. They're going to live and die by the deal. And to some extent, we want that to happen, but not at the cost of people's ability to move beyond emotional paralysis and remain productive. So we got to balance that. And I just find that we're not always balancing it.
I think the live and dying by the deal, or live and dying by the monthly forecast, or live and dying by the quarterly forecast, there's no doubt that leaders create that environment,
right,
where the organization, even by the way, at the micro level, yeah. This was back in the wintertime, but I sat down with a group of leaders. I had seven leaders from seven different teams that came in and worked with me, and I could name the culture on each of those teams,
really,
based on the leader. Like, I'd meet with their teams and meet with the leader, and you could just see it. The team was a reflection of the leader.
Sure.
But if the leader is living on a roller coaster deal by deal by deal, the team's going to live on a roller coaster deal by deal by deal. One of the problems with that is if you're living on that roller coaster, the salespeople will eventually start lying to you so that they don't have to feel your wrath when the deal is going backwards or going the wrong way. So
yeah.
You end up not getting the right information. One suggestion I have in situations like that, rather than being a deal-focused organization where you're living and dying based on what's happening in the pipeline or what's happening in the month, is to be a process-focused organization. So my preference is living and dying on process goals. So process goals are how many of this, how many of that, how many of this. Ben Hogan, one of the greatest golfers of all time,
yes,
said, focus on the cause, not the result. So a cause-focused organization or culture is more resilient because you're able to get wins in a whole lot of places. A deal-focused organization is less resilient because your entire emotion is wrapped up on whether you close the deal or don't close the deal. And there's a lot of variables in that you have no control over.
And that's why the deal, the deal-based culture is ultimately dysfunctional. So we have functional and dysfunctional cultures, you know. And so by sharing the 10 dimensions of diligence, again, everything upstream from growing relationships, situational intelligence, all the way through to like winning drive. And winning drive is an interesting one because it helps harness a salesperson's ambition and connects it to the strategy of the organization. So it's not this unbridled ambition.
Yes.
It's channeled properly. But anything related to service mindset, winning drive, inner resolve is designed to function as both the solution but also a mirror to help evaluate your culture. How diligent are we in the middle part of the race?
Yeah.
After we've started fast and enthusiastic, are we staying the course? It's a mirror for leaders to consider.
One thing you said there, which is that ambition alignment.
Yes.
So high agency, high level leaders, one of the commonalities, especially in sales, is that they are masters at aligning individual goals with organizational goals. Not an easy thing to do, but when they're sitting down and having conversations with people, they're aligning values and they're finding a way to create bridges between those values. And they're sitting down with salespeople and they're asking them about their individual personalized ambitions and goals. And they're showing them how by helping the organization get here, you can get here. Pulling those two things together, they create this synchronicity and this this power that is really hard to replicate, but it's almost hard to stop. I'll give you an example of this from my early career. I stumbled on this as a sales leader, but I took over the worst sales team in the country for my company. There were 52 sales teams. This was number 52. It was literally the armpit of the company. It wasn't functioning. It was completely dysfunctional for all kinds of reasons. It was bigger than just the sales organization. It was the operation organization. It was the history of this place. It was terrible. So one of the things that I just did was, and I stumbled on this, is I would have breakfast with my salespeople before I would go out with them in the morning. So we would just stop at like a Perkins restaurant or what have you, have some eggs and bacon and grits because we're in the South. And we would just talk about what was coming up in the day. And I started in these conversations just asking the salespeople, like, what do you want? Like, what are your goals? Like, what are you trying to accomplish? Just to get a conversation going. Because you have breakfast with somebody. I mean, eventually you got to talk about something. And they would start telling me what their goals were. So over the course of those conversations, I would start writing down what is it that they wanted. And they wanted things like swimming pools, or they wanted to save for their kids' college, or they wanted to feel more financially secure, or they wanted a vacation, or whatever it was. So I would write it down, and then I would start asking them, what do we think we need to do in order to get you in position so that you can get that win? And we would start breaking down their activity. The organization had this set of expectations. It was a culture of accountability. Here are the expectations. And our job as a leader was to shove those expectations down our salespeople's throat. I stopped talking about them completely. The only thing I talked about was what my salespeople wanted and the numbers that they gave me, not me giving them, that would help them get what they wanted, which were oftentimes higher and more dialed in than the numbers that the organization wanted us to shove down their throat. And my team started winning. I mean, they were the bad news bears. I'm telling you, a group of losers that everybody wanted to fire everybody. And I just got the job because they had to put me someplace. And I was like, I'm going to leave the company if you don't give me a leadership job. So I got the job. The team got on fire. 9 months later, we're the number one sales organization, the sales team, 10 salespeople in this market center in the whole company. Number one, the whole thing was that alignment of ambition with the organization. Once we had that down, we were both driving down the same path and we were winning and we were talking about the things that were important to them. And by the way, them buying into those future goals, that gave them resilience because when things were going bad, they had an anchor. They had something to look over the horizon and find the discipline to then go dial themselves into.
I love that. And what I think you described, and it sounds like that came second nature to you, I have found in all my work consulting, it's actually a rare leadership skill. I don't see that a lot. And that was the sort of thing I wanted to weave into the diligence fix. What was some of the discretionary effort that you pull 10 sales leaders on a field and you know, 9 of them won't do it? But what does that one person do? And I tried to embed those lessons in there. And you asked me about the courses, right? What's some of the ways that we approach it in the courses? Well, sales leaders don't have a lot of time. So we cut right to the chase, crisp, clean definition of what we're talking about. We frame what is the mindset you need to have, because I think you would agree that, you know, sales leadership starts with hearts and minds, right? You have to get people focused. What are our core beliefs? And then I always touch on watch outs. What are the 3 behaviors that if you don't watch for these, it's going to disable where you want to go? And then there's questions, 3 questions to ask to tee this up with your team. And then there's a quick summary at the end. And it's all designed with adult learning theory, a lot of reinforcement in the short courses, but designed ultimately to make things actionable. Each course comes with a PowerPoint. You can adopt that PowerPoint, drop it in a lunch and learn with your managers, and off you go.
Love that.
Yeah.
And folks, the reason that we're talking about sales leadership courses from experts like Dana, and we're putting them on SalesGrave University, you can check them out at learn.salesgravy.com. The reason we're doing this is because we'll talk about this in the next segment is primarily because organizations really don't put a lot of effort in training leaders. So many of you who are leaders and you're listening to this, one day you got promoted because you were the number one sales rep and they gave you a business card and it said sales manager on it. And they said, go forth and prosper. And then you realized it was a whole lot harder than you thought it was. And you're dealing with all these human beings that they don't always do what you want them to do. And really the hardest thing to do in sales is lead salespeople, because salespeople are crazy, they're weird, and they're hyper emotional. And we all know that. And I'm talking bad about the people that I love the most, but the fact is that you don't have a lot of opportunities to learn specific sales leadership skills. So at SalesGrave University, we've built this with contributors like Dana so that we can have a place for sales leaders to go where it's safe for you to go learn without any judgment. And you can start building those skills, because ultimately you're going to win when your people win, and your people win when you get better at helping them achieve the goals that are important to them. So look, if you're a leader and you want to go check it out, go to learn.salesgravy.com, learn.salesgravy.com. If you've never taken a course on SalesGrave University and you have to, this will be your first course you've ever taken, just use the code FREECOURSE. You can take any course you want, pick any of them, take it absolutely free. We think you're going to love it and you're going to stick around. Just use the code FREECOURSE at learn.salesgravy.com. So that was a gratuitous plug for what I believe is the most powerful sales training engine on earth. But I do think that having you here is huge for us, because it adds to a growing library of sales leadership training that we need, and we just desperately need as much as we possibly can, because I think a lot of leaders are really struggling to find their way in a world where companies will spend millions of dollars literally training the salespeople and almost nothing training sales leaders.
And it's hard to put your hand up and say, could I get training too? Because there's this perception that, like, well, I'm already supposed to know all these things because I was promoted to leader. And so what I love about the platform is there's like a discreet way to go in there and supplement your own knowledge and skills. And then again, the way I've set mine up is it comes, each one of them comes with a PowerPoint that follows the outline of the course so you can adopt it as your own.
I like it. I also think that companies think that providing leadership training or coaching training, the same training that they provide with to the HR team and the accounting team and the operations team and, you know, all the other people in the organization, every frontline leader gets it, that somehow that is a checkbox mark that you've trained a sales leader. And I'd love to get your opinion on this, but I just feel like there's no other group of people in an organization like salespeople. Leading salespeople is a unique profession. I can't give you generic leadership training, and that's going to suddenly make you a great sales leader.
I mean, it might work for HR, but it's probably not going to work to move the needle in your sales leader's capability. I was telling your team last night, one of the things I'm researching right now to get a more concrete sort of prescription for is what is the delta between what, you know, general leadership training often looks like, whether they build or buy it in the organization, versus what is required to truly help and enable a sales leader. I will tell you that the starting point for that is recognizing, and this is something that I take up in my role as CXO, realizing that as you move up the ladder, you're no longer, you know, overseeing a book of business, a territory, a manager, a bunch of managers. You are the captain of the revenue system. You are required to understand the role marketing plays, sales, solution, service, and to some degree, operations. You need to understand how those levers are pulled to deliver value to the customer. And you're not going to get that from a corporate program.
No, and to that point, most corporations and organizations aren't teaching the sales leaders how a P&L works.
Right.
Right. Or because I hear this all the time from a sales leader where they have a operations leader who's upset because a division or a location is losing money. And then they're pushing that wrath down onto the sales leader, and the sales leader's coming to me going, like, I have no idea how to fix this problem. I don't even know what a P&L is. And by the way, true in my own organization. So I realized a couple of years ago that I'm talking to people about financial issues and they don't even know how we make money. Like, so you're asking people to make decisions about things and they don't understand how all the pieces fit together. And in a smaller organization, that's a little easier to do because we are flat. And a larger organization, it's tough to do. But you also mentioned that the majority of companies, I would say we're in the 95% or 99% range, don't think about replacing a sales leader or hiring a sales leader or promoting a sales leader until they need a sales leader.
Right.
There's no thought process about, hey, we need to build bench strength. You'll build bench strength for the C-suite all day long. Like, you're working on all of the vice presidents and you're thinking about what the succession plan is into the C-suite, but you've got these revenue generating centers inside the organization led by a human being that's surrounded by anywhere from 5 to 15 salespeople that are generating, in some cases, millions and millions of profitable dollars. And you don't even think about replacing what you're going to do to replace them or who you're going to replace them with until the wheels fall off.
Isn't that amazing? Why do you think that is?
I think it's also true for sales leaders, right?
Yeah.
I don't think sales leaders think about, do I need to have a group of new sales candidates in play before I fire somebody or before I lose somebody? They don't think, this person showed me the pattern that they're going to quit. Do I have someone to take their place? So you'll have a sales team that'll leave a space open for months. If they had just looked ahead, they would have filled it up. I don't think that organizations, I'm not sure they even value or understand how powerful sales leaders are. Like, they're the most important person on the sales team. Your sales team lives and dies not by your superstar, by your sales leader. And so you will not invest time and effort in building a bench if you don't get that first. If I get that first, then I recognize that I need to be building a bench months away. And you said this, if the sales leader is a revenue center and there's all these other dots that connect out there and we want to teach them how the business works, some business acumen, well, they're not going to get that through a fire hose. So why not teach them over a period of time? Identify top-level people in your organization. Your leaders can look at people who say, hey, I want to be a leader, or I have the potential to be a leader. You can go to them and say, we've got a plan for you. We're going to take you through a process of learning the business. And by the way, the people that you do that with, they'll stick around a lot longer, because when you're investing in people, they like you more. They want to stick with you more. They see a future and value in that. And you tell the whole organization, like, there's a place for you here, but you have to be intentional about it, and you got to create the program. So two things happen. Either it gets so overcomplicated that nobody can do it, or too expensive that nobody wants to do it, or you just don't see the value in it. So
One of the real barriers that I've heard, so I have been able to successfully, primarily in consulting opportunities, ask people, you know, what are you doing for succession? And you'll always hear the same line. We need to build a pipeline, you know, for sales leaders, a manager, leader, director track, all of that. And then I say to them, well, what stands in your way of doing that? And you know what I often hear? I often hear, well, you know, obviously it's costly, number one. But number two, we can't always guarantee spots for people when it's all said and done. But I said, why? Like, why would that keep you from building people who are experts in how your company makes money, who it serves, and how to optimize?
I've been through that. I told you a story off camera about a program like this that I put together a long time ago when I was running a sales organization, a large sales organization. And that was something that came up. Like, okay, well, we put people through the program, they're going to expect a spot immediately. That is a human condition, right? Yeah. We're projecting our values on someone else. We're deciding for them 12 months from now what they're going to want.
Right.
And what we found was that as we put the people through this program, there was a certain percentage of them, about 30% of them, that would get in the middle of the program and go, you know what? I've learned enough. I don't want to be in leadership. This was helpful. Thank you. But they walked away with a better understanding of the organization and a clearer vision of where we were going to go than other people. The rest of them, we just said, you're on the bench. Like, once you get out of this program, you're going to be next. And A, you have to be willing to move. So like, if you're not willing to move, then we got a job. You're probably not going to get it. It's not going to come to you. You have to move to that market. And B, we're going to take a look at the whole body of work. We're going to look at here. You're first in line, but you also have to keep your sales numbers up.
Mm-hmm.
So believe it or not, we ended up moving those people through the system way faster than we ever expected. But the individuals didn't get out of the program thinking, oh, well, they don't have anything for right now. I'm quitting. They got out of the program thinking, when positions open, I'm already on the list. Which was true.
Mm-hmm.
So they were already on the list. Now, if we pass someone over for 5 years in a row, maybe they wouldn't be. But it turns out that the turnover at sales leadership positions is about every 24 months. You're burning through people. So
what are the odds?
The jobs are going to be there. And if nothing else, if the person decides they're going to leave and go on, well, you've got an ally in another company that you built and you grew, and you know it'll come back. Karma will come back to you. But I think that that's the thing that people do all the time. We worry about some eventuality that doesn't even exist.
All comes back to mindset.
Yep. We're not resilient enough to deal with a situation where we don't have an immediate job for someone. You think about it like that.
Exactly.
Let's talk about culture for a second. So you and I, while you've been here, we've been talking a lot about culture. Let's start with, why does culture matter for sales organizations? Now, I talked about microcultures, the culture that builds around an individual sales manager. My favorite role ever was that role because I could build my own tribe. They reflected me. I built my culture. I think every leader is going to build their own sort of microculture with their team. But we're talking about at the macro level, at the organization level, culture. Why does culture matter for an organization when it comes to sales?
Yeah. So what's so interesting about it, it's an important framing question, and yet it's not hard to start the conversation because I've yet to find a leader that hasn't in one way or another talked about their views on culture, what they aspire it to be, and so forth. I essentially like to drill it down to the fact, you know, again, it's how we do things around here, but culture either enables or disables your big rock goals. That's it. I really like to attribute it to, are you forcing your salespeople by way of a dysfunctional culture to hike up a mountain with a backpack full of rocks? So your culture is either enabling or disabling.
I like that. Okay. That's a pretty good way of looking at it. So if you're a leadership team and you're listening to this and you have a set of goals, business targets, that the sales team is going to be part of driving because of growth, what you choose to have as your culture either is going to help you get there or not help you get there.
Exactly.
Okay, what is culture?
Culture is a collection of the way we do things around here. So it's the mindset, it's the beliefs, and it's the behaviors we either reward, tolerate, or, you know, risk unaddressing.
Is it language?
It's part of it, but I always love to stress that culture is so much more than words on a wall or a book I read at the airport last week.
I'm thinking more like, because I think about how training fits into culture.
Mm-hmm.
So one of our selling points at Sales Gravy is that we're practitioners. So every one of my trainers is carrying a briefcase selling.
Mm-hmm.
It's our culture. Because I can't think of a group of people that can call out BS faster than a group of salespeople.
Right.
And if they don't think that you got it,
they're not
paying attention. And some of my trainers are like Brad, you met Brad over here?
Yes.
Yeah. Brad sells a lot. Like, he's making a lot of money selling. I got other trainers where training is much more their passion than selling,
mm-hmm.
but everybody's got a number.
Right.
Because you got to show up. That's a cultural thing, right?
Yes.
That's our language. But I also think about when I'm sitting down with companies and they're saying, okay, what are you going to teach us? What I say to them is training builds culture, because training is language. Because when we get done, you're going to start calling things certain things. You're going to say certain things. Like, if we bring in Fanatical Prospecting Bootcamp, Fanatical Prospecting as language, it starts becoming part of your culture. This is what we do, as you said that. So when companies say, well, how do you do that? I say, well, you know, if you think about training, there's two ways of doing it. One is that you fit into a predefined box, which most training companies out there, and maybe you disagree with this, but most training companies, they've got a box and everybody fits in the same box, right? You describe one situation where you left a training organization. We won't say a name, but you left because you just got tired of the same old box. The box just wasn't expanding and helping the companies. The way we do training is we build the box around our customers. And that includes, we have particular things that we say in training. If those things that we say in training are not going to support that company's culture, we'll change the nomenclature so that we support the company's culture. We go into a lot of our clients, we take all of our logos off of our material because we don't want the salespeople to ever think that it wasn't the company's idea.
Love it.
So that it doesn't allow them to say, oh, that's outside of us. Because if it's outside of us, then it's something that we have permission to ignore.
Yes, we're not responsible for it.
Exactly. But if we created it ourselves, so we'll do enough research so that we're not only just speaking their language, but using their own colors, using their logos. Because I think it's that important. I think the way a company talks internally matters. Not just like you said, slogans on a wall,
mm-hmm.
but it's the way they say things. And training builds that foundation.
It does. And so when I talk about kind of the culture formula, it's the framework or the North Star. What do you want your culture to be? A performance culture, a collaborative culture, continuous learning? What is it, right? What is the North Star? What's the framework? Then it's breaking it down into tactics, being really clear. What are the beliefs, the mindsets? And then how do we behave around here, right? This is what we do today. But what do we do in terms of modifying behaviors and reinforcing behaviors? And then to your point about language, training, all of that is necessary change management. Because if your culture is X today and you want it to be Y, it is no different than a change management initiative. And you've got to follow those rituals.
That's powerful. I like that. Okay, but let me throw something to you. Okay,
sure.
You said we're a learning culture, okay?
You could be.
Could be.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit about dysfunction. I'm going to throw a couple of things on the table because I'm curious about this. But let's just say that we're a learning culture. You hear that a lot out of L&D. We're going to be a learning culture. And when I have people say that to me, we're going to be a learning culture, I'm like, okay, well, what are you committed to? Well, we're committed to training and giving people training. I go, great. Are you committed to teaching the same things over and over again? Because I'll hear learning culture, but that just means we're going to train. That doesn't mean that we are going to build skills that are repeatable. Resilience, right? Resilience is, I don't have to think about it. I'm on the field. I'm learning. So many learning cultures, we're just throwing training at people, but we'll go, oh, well, they already had that training before. Not realizing that, especially for sales, like you talk about, like resilience is one, but getting along with other people, asking questions, influence, being able to build relationships, almost every skill in sales outside of technical things is perishable. Like, you can be really good at it today and you'll be terrible at it next month. Mm-hmm. But learning organizations that I know that are learning organizations, they're repetition, 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 repetition. You go to the same training every single year because their goal is to make sure that they've picked a lane. This is what we're going to do. And they're going to train it until it's rote. Right? That's part of that change management piece, right?
Absolutely. Well, and what I talk about, kind of, there's learning, there's training, right? So when I think about a continuous learning culture, what I'm thinking about is, let's say you invest in training, and let's say you even repeat the same training. Training can be episodic, it can be serial, but a learning culture takes that investment so seriously. We talk about multi-threading, right, in the sales context. They multi-thread those lessons
exactly
throughout their operation.
They have chosen. So when we're sitting down with the company, we're like, you pick us, pick someone else, but pick a complete system.
That's right.
Because our framework for, say, having a conversation with someone in a sales environment, we use that same framework when it comes to customer experience and customer success, but we use it in a different context. But no matter where you go, you're going to hear the same language and the same frameworks. They're going to all layer together in the same boat. But here's a question for you, and this is where I was thinking. So you've got L&D, human resources, said we're going to be a learning culture. And let's say the organization says we're going to be a learning culture. But you walk into the sales organization, and the sales organization is on the hook for a number. The shareholders are screaming. The executive group is screaming. The sales leaders go, learning culture isn't getting us anywhere. Like, we're going to be an accountability culture.
Yes. Well, cultures aren't edicts. So just because L&D or HR or anybody else in a position of authority or influence announces that, does not a culture make. And so at the end of the day, if a sales leader hasn't driven a stake in the ground to say what they want their culture to be within, you know, the performance lane, then it'll create a vacuum, right? And it'll just take on the everyday actions and reactions of that sales leader.
But is that not part of the dysfunction, is that the organization, you know, the leadership and organization doesn't put a stake in the ground? And
it's abdication.
And live and die by that. They just throw platitudes that this is a learning culture. But my question is, let's say we don't put the stake in the ground, but let's say we put the stake in the ground and we said we're going to be this culture.
Right.
What if that culture is at the opposite end of what it takes to drive a sales organization? Like, you say we're going to be a learning culture. That's soft, right? We're learning. We're going to be an accountability culture. That's hard, mm-hmm. right? Like, I've worked in an accountability culture, forecasting, right? When you gave a forecast, you were writing a check. That check better not bounce. The accountability was, you bounce that check a couple of times, you're going to be working in another company.
Well, and I will say that out of all the CROs, VPs of sales that I've worked with, 9.5 times out of 10, that's what they say they want to be. And yet most of them, I mean, I hate to say this, but I'm being truthful. Most of them don't push it any further than just the edict.
Saying it.
We're right. going to be an accountability culture. So one of the courses that I put on Sales Gravy is called Top Performer Privilege.
Yep.
And so I, of all the years that I developed training and I personally piloted them, there's always, and I'm not picking on tan guys and in a Hawaiian shirt, but I'm going to make a point.
Yeah.
There's always the overly tan, fun, golf loving, Hawaiian shirt wearing guy who just kind of sits back in training. And this does not apply to me, but I'm here to crack jokes and basically create this air that this isn't for me. Like, I'm too important for this. And yet, that's the person who's likely least accountable. Why? Because maybe they've inherited a great book of business. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're, you know, golf buddies with the folks who, you know, are the highest customer of the company. The point of the matter is, that person gets a carve out the minute that person isn't as accountable as somebody coming up through the organization. You've broken the culture that you want to build.
Yeah. So, and like, I've just explained this to my wife, like, the last couple of months, this is sort of, as a consultant, been my number one issue. I've got C-level executives calling me mm-hmm. because they've got their top producer who is acting like an ass. You know, I'm talking about
kind of on brand. Right? Yeah.
And they want to know what to do about it.
Right.
What do we do about this?
Yeah.
And that, it's a conundrum.
It is.
But this is kind of what you say. We can be a culture of top performance. And that's really always been my culture. My culture has always been, look, you can be a diva all you want to, as long as you're putting numbers on the board. But the moment you quit putting numbers on the board, you're coming down into living in the real world with real people, and I'm going to tell you what you're going to do. And as long as we have that contract, we're good. And as long as you're not lying, cheating, stealing, or hurting other people, do you think? That's a different culture than a accountability culture.
It is.
Right.
I like that differentiation because it is different. And sometimes sales leaders think they can have a mashup, but you actually can't. You got to pick.
Yeah. The culture is.
Yeah.
It's a top performance culture. Top performers do get treated differently. It's not a democracy.
Right.
If you lie, cheat, steal, if you cross my red line, you're done.
Yeah.
You can't be saved. In our world, we always show up. That is the red line in the sand. You cross that red line, I don't care who you are. You won't be here anymore. And we all know that, right? Everybody gets it. So I think you can have a little bit of both. But I think what you said was you're going to put a stake in the ground.
Right.
You either live and die by that stake.
Yes.
Or nobody's going to pay attention
They're
to you.
They're not. I mean, they might give you lip service, like you said earlier, tell you what you want to hear. But you'll feel it. You'll feel it as you walk the proverbial halls, right? That this isn't a culture that has gelled. This is not a culture that's cohesive. And if you're okay with that, fine. But if you really do take seriously culture building, these are the kinds of conversations we have to have.
Well, I mean, it's just like if you've got kids and you keep telling your kids that if they quit doing something, you're not going to take them for ice cream, and they keep doing it and you take them for ice cream, they're just going to keep doing it. But let's go back to 1999, Salesforce.com, really starting to like move into their own, where they've just begun to like be in the cloud. Those were the moments from like 1999 to like 2003. We've got these big implementations of enterprise level CRM. And we're all sitting in rooms with people and we're telling them, if you don't put in the CRM, you're out of here.
Yeah, right.
And nobody fired their top performers who said, I'm just going to keep these things on my index cards and on a spreadsheet and you'll figure it out later. And here we are in 2026 and we're still having the same conversation.
It's true.
So if those organizations had said, look, if you don't put it in here, you're gone, you would have had that culture of putting things in the CRM. The thing that sales leaders know is that that's not necessarily a culture that's going to result in more sales. It's just going to result in a better CRM. So we always have those trade-offs. So I think what I'm hearing you say, because I love the stake in the ground analogy. It's one that one of my top mentors taught me. It's like, when you're a leader, you put a stake in the ground. And when you put that stake in the ground and you say that that's what we're going to do, everybody knows that that's what you're going to do.
That's right.
That is the only way that as a leader, you're going to move the organization forward, because you're going to have to move that stake. And everybody's going to know when you move the stake, that is the word of God. So I think you got to be careful about and thoughtful about what you want your organization to do, what you want them to believe, what you want them to actualize, because the long term downstream impact of that is going to affect what you actually want, which means that essentially your culture has to align with your ultimate business objectives. Is that right? Or am I missing something?
It should, because that's going to be the type of culture that is most likely to feel authentic and thus gain traction. One thing I wanted to add on to what you said about the stake in the ground is the minute you plant that stake in the ground, be prepared for people to watch you as the leader. They're gonna watch, do you model what you say that you want? Because if it's, you know, rules for thee, but not for me, again, it's gonna impede the traction. So you have to have good fit between your culture framework and what business you're in, who you serve in terms of customers. But then the minute you plant that stake, you invite all of this visibility onto your own actions. And so I think a lot of leaders think that, like, just because I say it, people are going to do it, but they're watching you. And then they're watching how you treat other people. And are you consistent? And do you still remember that you planted this stake 3, 6, 9, 12 months from now? Or is it just the soup du jour? I know a lot of people that just say, hey, my sales leader comes up with a new thing every month. I just kind of wait him out or her out.
So that's one of the list of the, I think you have 4 dysfunctions of culture here, right? So that's one of your dysfunctions is leaders don't model the behavior.
Right.
What about some other dysfunctions? I mean, you've got shifting priorities. You've got frequent leadership changes. I get that one.
Yeah.
Lack of clarity.
That's my favorite.
Is that your favorite?
Lack
okay,
of
I was going to ask you.
Clarity is my absolute
talk
favorite.
Talk to me about lack of clarity.
So if you asked any member on my team, they would say like the number one kind of brand that I've tried to establish in my role is clarity. I want you to believe exactly what I said, why it's important, what I'm prepared to do about it, and what I need you to do about it and why. And I think as leaders treat clarity as the number one capability that they develop, practice, hone, and continue to exhibit, that is one of the key differentiators. And culture depends on the leader being clear and consistent.
Yeah, Dave Ramsey in Entre Leadership, he talks about clarity all over and over and over again. He says clarity is kindness.
It is. And I believe that.
It's something that I would say that I probably suffer from lack of clarity sometimes because I'm just one of these guys that have so many ideas and so many things going on. And my wife says, who's our COO, she's like, I always have to come behind you and you walk into a room and you say things and then I have to come in behind you and interpret everything that you said.
So you know what I call that? Idea confetti.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, you go to like football games and they shoot, you know, the confetti out of the canister. There's people that enjoy that ride. And then there's people like me who will say, who's gonna clean all that up? Who's going to clean that up the next day?
Yeah.
Idea confetti.
Yeah, that's
which
me.
Is energizing, right? Yeah. It's fun.
It's just where we fit. And so I constantly run that thing in my head, you know, through my head, Dave Ramsey saying, clarity is kindness, clarity is kindness, clarity is kindness.
It's the number one thing. And you know what I find is if a leader is in a role where maybe they're presenting to the board, they're presenting to the C-suite, they have no choice but to carefully, you know, speak that message with clarity, brevity, all those things. And yet when they communicate downward, now all of a sudden it doesn't come with that same succinctness. Why? Like these are the challenges that I think that we have to explore.
You have four on here. I'm gonna throw a five on the table.
Let's do it.
That creates dysfunction.
Yeah.
And that is that. This is for sales culture, right?
Yeah.
It is when sales leaders fail to protect their people from the organization.
Mm.
So what I always tell sales leaders is you're an umbrella. Your job is to hold the umbrella over your sales team and make sure that none of the rain that's coming from the organization touches them so that they can go out there and continue to execute. And maybe that fits into clarity, right? But I just feel like organizations throw so much at their sales teams. Like the HR department wakes up one day and says, we're going to make this change. Or the marketing team wants the sales organization to come into a 2 o'clock meeting in the middle of the sales day to talk about a new product line. And they've already created talk tracks for everything without running it by the sales organization.
Right.
Or there's some change that's happening or whatever. Sales leaders, their job is to protect the salespeople from that, to maintain that culture that they want. And where I see problems is when that doesn't happen. Like the sales leaders allow their salespeople to experience
the full weight of what's coming at them.
All the noise with no filter.
So I love the word filter. One of the things that I would say to kind of add additional detail to number five there is when noise is coming from leadership, I think your role as a sales leader is to contextualize, help them understand why that's coming out now. And then I think if it's coming laterally or sort of, you know, bottom up, filter and constantly continue to emphasize the priorities. Don't assume everybody knows how to prioritize in the same way that a leader that has a bird's eye view knows how to do.
I love that. Well, prioritization would be another dysfunction that impacts culture is when the leader, and again, I think this goes back to clarity, right? But
yes.
It's when people don't understand what our priorities are. Like, what am I supposed to be doing at any given moment? That, I think, can be a major issue, especially for sales organizations. I think that when we go back to the filter piece with sales leaders, this is in particular the umbrella piece, is I see leaders who they get in cahoots with their sales team. So something comes, an edict comes down from a high, they don't like it. So they sit with their sales team and whine and complain because they feel like that makes them more authentic because they're with the sales team.
Interesting.
Except for now the sales team becomes the enemy of the organization versus its conduit. The other is the sales leader who is so gung-ho about the company that everything that comes down, even if it's complete crap, goes, this is the greatest thing ever. We're going to do this. And everybody's looking at the leader and going, I mean, do you have no feelings whatsoever? Do you have no opinion?
Sure.
And I think the leaders that are in the middle, and this goes, again, I think back to clarity, the ones that I've always respected, because I've had a little bit of both, but I've primarily had the leader who's so gung-ho about the organization that they're changing something that everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
Every salesperson knows when they're changing a policy that's going to impact sales. We know that. And we're looking at the leader and going, don't you see this is going to be harmful? And the leader's like, no, we're going to do this. The ones that I've always respected are the ones that say, okay, this stinks. It's not exactly how I would have done things. It's not what I want to do. But The last time I looked, the guy that signs our paycheck is the person in the office over there, and that person said this is what we're going to do. So I need everybody to come together and let's figure out how we can accomplish this goal without hurting ourselves downstream. And now you've pulled everybody in. You've acknowledged that it's not the thing that you would do, but you've also said to them, that's okay. Our job in many cases is to take what we've been given and make the best of it.
So I love that, because what you've just described again is what I would consider to be an advanced sales leadership skill. Very much like when you took your sales team out to breakfast at Perkins and you went around, you found out what everybody wanted and you connected it to the bigger purpose. When we talk about the delta between what general leadership training offers and what we actually need to skill up leaders that oversee the revenue generating organization, these are two big ones. And if we can get a sense of what that is, not only can we help build stronger cultures, but we're going to build stronger leaders who are at the helm to sustain the culture.
I like it. Very good. So you introduced something to me that I'm a big fan of.
Oh, yeah?
Like, I got crazy about this. This is how we're going to end this thing, because we've talked a little bit about the dysfunction, but we've talked about what makes it more functional, which is, I think, clarity is number one. But you introduced this concept of cultural menu, and we've touched on it a little bit, but I love it, because it's like, okay, if I'm sitting down and I'm listening to this and I'm a sales leader and I go, I don't feel like the sales culture is as functional as it should be. I'm not saying that you're completely dysfunctional. Some of you are, but you know, you say, I want a new start, or I want to change, or I feel like I want a culture that enables us to hit our goals versus disables us hitting our goals. How would we begin using your concept of cultural menu?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we talk about kind of culture again being the framework. What's the North Star? What is the label that we would communicate to our team, our new hires, all those things? Like, what culture do we have? Is it accountability, transparency, continuous learning? Are we all about data-based decisions? What is it, right? So you start there. What do I want for dinner? Like, what do I want to order up on a culture? And then it's really distilling the framework into beliefs, mindset, behavior, tactics. That's really it.
Say it one more time.
Yeah. Belief, mindsets, behavior, and tactics.
Okay.
So that's like you choose your best fit menu item or your culture framework, and then you rally around definitions that are tailored and authentic for your organization, but follow that formula. And then you apply to that, again, a good old-fashioned change management. What's the current state? What's my desired state? And given the circumstances, the pacing, the obstacles here, how long is it reasonable for us to get there? How do we engineer this together? And then again, it doesn't reside with one person. How can you get other stakeholders involved? This is all part of good old-fashioned change management, but how can you bring champions in? How can you set up reasonable, attainable milestones to see that you're making progress? To me, it's a really exciting way to get started in a small manner doing big things. So rather than just talking about how important culture is, we're taking the steps forward.
Let me ask you a weird question. Can you like have multiple layers of your culture? Like, I look at these things and say, okay, I'm a customer-centric culture.
Sure.
But we're also a data-driven decision culture. And I could see how that would confuse people, because in a lot of cases, if you're a customer-centric culture, you don't make decisions always based on data. You make decisions based on what's the right thing for human beings.
And that starts to me with kind of that initial defining.
Okay.
So let's say you had the menu and you said, literally, I want a mashup between the two. I would always say, just start with the first one. Start with customer-centric. And then talk about what does being customer-centric mean here? How do we approach the customer? What are their needs and wants? How do we make decisions? One of my favorites. How do we operate in the gray areas?
Yeah.
Like,
when there's a gray area,
what do we do? How do we handle that in a way that is consistent with the culture we want to build? And I think that it's co-authored is a big word that I use in my role. Co-authored with your peers, because again, it's not just sales, it's marketing, it's enablement, it's customer service. You're all part of the revenue system. You can't have all these micro cultures that are slightly different from one another. You have to bring in your peers, your partners from across that revenue organization. Co-author it together. Start with the framework. Start with mindset and beliefs. And from there, it will naturally grow into what behaviors are ideal and what are our watchouts. And so if you want to get started today on the Sales Gravy platform, I lay out each of those 10 diligence dimensions almost like a menu and serve up those starting points in to 6 minutes.
I love it. If you want to learn more about Dana, go to thediligencefix.com. If you want to learn more about culture, we're going to have her courses up on Sales Gravy University very soon. So as a leader, come in, check out those courses. We've got an entire catalog for sales leaders. And this has been a pleasant and delightful conversation about culture. I could do this all day long and like really starting to dial into these things. But I love the last thing that you said, which is, and I think this is the most important, when you say the words, the next question is, what does this mean in our context? So if you said customer centric, what does that mean here? That I think is probably the most brilliant mic drop of the entire conversation, because that's not what we often do. What does that mean to us? And in that definition, you're going to find the language that you have to use to explain it to everyone else so that they understand it the same way you do.
Goes back to clarity.
I love that. All right, y'all. If you have not taken a course on Sales Gravy University, use the code FREECOURSE. Go to learn.salesgravy.com, learn.salesgravy.com. If you're a leader and you have a team, we have this amazing team hub set up that allows you to bring your entire team in, get an administrative seat, get full reporting, get an account manager on our team that will help you build learning paths and bring your people through. And by the way, if you're a small company, you can even put your content on Sales Gravy University in your team hub, so we become your learning center. And if you're a big company and you've got a big old LMS and you're looking for fresh new content for your sales organization, which I know that you are because we always are, we have the ability to easily and seamlessly integrate Sales Gravy University directly into your LMS in just a couple of clicks, and we've got programs for you as well. Go check it out at learn.salesgravy.com, learn.salesgravy.com, and we will see you next time on the Sales Gravy Podcast.
The Sales Gravy Podcast is sponsored by Nooks. Nooks is a signal-first workspace that turns real-time intent into real conversations. Their AI agents monitor LinkedIn and CRM signals to tell your team exactly who to reach and what to say. Think of it as having an agent that thinks exactly like your best rep. And when it comes to tools, you can stop searching and start winning with Nooks. So check out Agent Workspace for Sales at nooks.ai. That's Nooks.ai.